Hi everybody and welcome to episode 3 of News from a World in Flux. My name is Claire Farrell. I'm one of the co-founders of Extinction Rebellion.
I'm Dr. Charlie Gardner. I'm a conservation scientist with Scientists for Extinction Rebellion.
And we're hosting these discussions to try and draw attention to the things that we think aren't getting enough focus in the climate conversation, clearing up matters of disinformation and misinformation, and checking in on narratives that we think maybe need a redirect. First of all, Charlie, what have you been up to since we last met?
I've been on holiday, which was wonderful. I spent a couple of weeks on taking a train across Europe, went to Poland, saw some wildlife. It's been really rejuvenating. It was really exciting, actually, to see how many people are taking the train nowadays, not flying. And now I'm back and immersing myself in all this incredible amount of news that's been happening over these last few weeks. So I hope we'll be able to get through some of it today.
Yeah.
How about you?
A bit of an overwhelming amount of things on our list to talk about, isn't there? I went to Germany on the train recently to go to a conference, which was really nice, with some old connections from the fashion industry. We're talking about fashion education, and a really beautiful conference talking about defashioning fashion education. So it's working with the ideas of this very gorgeous radical anthropologist, Sandra Neeson, and her ideas about how to think about a degrowth agenda for the fashion space, but do it through the lens of culture rather than economics, which is, I would say, a simple way to describe something that's got an awful lot of depth. But anyway, that was, well, it's just nice to go and print and hang out with people that like clothes for change.
It's really important to surround ourselves with uplifting people and have these experiences. I find it gives me the energy to keep going. But it's interesting to hear you talk about degrowth. I think that's a big subject that we haven't touched on yet. So it'd be good to do an episode one day soon about degrowth and how that applies to not just fashion, but all sorts of industries.
Yeah. Okay, let's put it on the list. Although the list is long enough, I think, for now. So today, we have got a lot of technical stuff we want to talk about, but actually, Rishi Sunak. So that's on the list, even though it's not something that's lacking inattention, but it feels like it's sort of sprung up to the top of the agenda and we need to say something about it. And then we're gonna have a look at the words of the governor of California before we move on to celebrate our friends Extinction Rebellion in the Netherlands.
Yay.
Okay, so my notes say, Rishi, what a knob.
That's quite a good summary, isn't it? You know, we've been fighting so hard all this time to get governments to put in place policies that will accelerate our transition towards a post-carbon economy. And of course, they've not been doing enough. They've not been doing anything like enough, but they have put in place some policies, some small steps in the right direction. And now what Rishi Sunak's done is he's undoing the small gains we've made. The UK was, as previously called itself, a leader in decarbonisation globally. We were the first country to set in place a decarbonisation target. And we have had some policies to help us on the way. So some of the key policies have been about facilitating the transition away from internal combustion engine based cars towards electric vehicles, and policies about reducing home energy use. So our homes are a huge source of our emissions in this country, and that's largely because we use this old gas infrastructure. So we've had this policy to start phasing out these gas boilers and things and ensure that they are, when they come to the end of their lives, they are replaced by heat pumps and other things, the technologies of the future. But what he's done is he's pushed back the deadlines that were in place, both on boilers and the sale of petrol cars. And it's just extraordinary, to be, despite everything we know, despite all the advice that the government are getting from their own advisors, they're ignoring it entirely.
And on boilers, is it not true that whilst Boris Johnson was in charge, he tried to push through a policy on boiler replacement and transitioning away from gas boilers? And I seem to remember at that time, the people in the media team in Extinction Rebellion were looking in depth at the work of the Global Warming Policy Foundation, and as they're now known, Net Zero Watch, sort of fake consumer think tank watchdog that says net zero is very bad for your granny, don't do it, it will be dangerous, or it will be bad for poor people that we really care about. And all of these press releases came out and they went blah, 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 blah. And then the stories started to come through the tabloids and through the Telegraph and the Mail. Then you saw this sort of backtracking in the debate that was happening with ministers. And I can't quite remember the outcome, but it was definitely a weakening of the position on it, where I thought that Boris Johnson had tried to be relatively, you know, forthright about at least the initial proposition of it. To me, it seems like we'll talk about this again in another episode. And we've already talked about think tanks before, but it feels to me like there is a real clarity coming through, is there not, about the influence of the sort of neoliberal fundamentalists that work in the lobbying and think tank space, and how that affects the politics of today, but also how they've seemed to have directed people like Liz Truss, directed the thinking and the actions of different politicians. I mean, I feel like personally watching what Rishi's doing is like, must be massively influenced from that space.
Yeah, I really, really think so. Yeah, the evidence is everywhere. And there's this two-pronged approach, isn't it, from these think tanks. One is the direct influence on government policies, but the other is in sort of trying to shape public opinion through the media. So, you know, representatives of these think tanks are always getting invited on TV chat shows and things to set the agenda, really. And they're doing it through the media as well. So as you talked about, you know, there's been this huge increase in think pieces in right-wing media against climate solutions, whatever it be it heat pumps, vehicles. You know, we've seen lots and lots of pieces in the media saying, you know, heat pumps are terrible, they'll cost you money or whatever. And then when you look at who's writing these pieces, the authors are, you know, either working for think tanks or, you know, directly working for the gas industry or whatever. So you have newspapers giving what appears to be an independent opinion piece to a writer who's, you know, spouting all this, you know, untruths and disinformation about, you know, these new technologies. And yet those people writing those pieces aren't independent at all. They're directly employed or receive funding from the industries that will, you know, lose as we transition to these new ones. So there's, you know, the influence is everywhere.
I'm just looking it up to find out where there's... I mean, the other thing that's interesting about people like Net Zero Watch is that when they get a policy win on their terms, they also press release that and say, this is a massive policy win for us. They've decided not to do this, and they've decided not to do that, and they've decided to roll back on that, and they've decided to cancel that ambition. And you can find it. I mean, it's very easy to find, and you can see the correlation between what they release on the press release end of their website and what you read in the newspapers.
Yeah. And often they're actually quite upfront about it. You know, when Liz Truss and Kwasi Kwarteng released their disastrous mini budget that, you know, had such a disastrous impact on the economy, as soon as that came out, you know, there were people at the Institute for Economic Affairs and things were touting it as their victory. These are our policies. And then when it all goes wrong, they disown it, of course. But also with Policy Exchange and their report on Extinction Rebellion that they published a few years ago, and their recommendations for cracking down on the rights to protest. You know, Rishi Sunak gave a speech to Policy Exchange and thanked them. You know, directly said, "Thank you for drafting our policy." So it's, you know, it's not hidden. It's in plain sight, this influence of these think tanks on government policy. And of course, we don't know who these think tanks are. We don't know who funds them. You know, it completely undermines our democracy because we're getting political decision making made by very small numbers of individuals, and we literally don't even know who they are.
Yeah. And the only money that's been exposed for a Policy Exchange that I've really heard about substantial funding, or one of the only sources, is oil money from America. So what I always say to people is that it's very concerning to me that this becomes a matter of national sovereignty, that if your legislation is being drafted for the interests of foreign money, not even just the interests of money that's here, it seems like that, you know, it's very clear to anyone, like, that that's you know, it's international kind of interference with legislation change.
Really dodgy. And everyone should be up in arms about this, regardless of your political position or who you identify as. That's dodgy as fuck, and we should not be accepting that.
Yeah. The other thing that's important to note about this is how many people inside the party have said, what the fuck are you doing? And, you know, Chris Skidmore, former energy minister, you know, said that this is probably the greatest mistake of his premiership. You've had other people from the Conservative Environment Network coming out and saying that it's not a good idea. People from his own advisory councils and stuff saying, no, this is actually just going to be really, really bad for the country. And then, of course, that sort of barrage of open letters and statements that come from the car sector and big business. I mean, I don't want to encourage anyone to think that we're going to electric vehicle our way out of the climate crisis. But for a car company to be writing to the Prime Minister saying what you've just said about tackling climate change is thick and bad for us and bad for everybody else. I mean, isn't that also quite extraordinary that you could have the motor industry going up against a rollback like that?
It is, yeah. So Ford said, you know, what we need is ambition. So this idea of stability is really, really important. You know, if you're a business or an industry, a sector, you're planning for the future, then, you know, you've been planning for net zero. You're planning to decarbonize because this is the signals that the government's given you. Now, if the government is suddenly saying, actually, don't worry about that, then, you know, they're telling you to go in another direction now. Mm. And people need to be able to predict what's coming. If all the society depends on, you know, planning and stuff. And if you can't plan because the government's just flip-flopping, then, yeah, really, no one wins. And, of course, the public see right through it. There was polling just came out, said 22% of the population trust Rishi Sunak on climate issues. So it's not a vote winner either. So it really is difficult. For me, it's really difficult to look beyond the influence of these dark money think tanks in working out why the hell he's done something just so absolutely bonkers and unpopular with everybody.
I think a lot of the analysis on this seems to be saying, well, he's just doing it because of the Uxbridge win. And obviously,
just explain what that was quickly.
So when there was a by-election in Uxbridge and the Tories won the seat, and they should really, by all accounts, have lost it because it used to be Boris Johnson's seat, and they didn't have a very big majority that they expected, they sent out, I think, quite a large amount of Conservative activists who went out and did a lot of work to try and shore up votes. But the picture that's been painted in the public conversation is that the entire fight was on ULEZ. So the argument is ULEZ is a wedge issue. We can disgrace Sadiq Khan, even though what he's brought in for ULEZ began under Boris Johnson's leadership as the mayor. So it's actually Boris Johnson's original work was the whole ULEZ plan. You know, he's just implemented it properly in order to try and clean up London's air pollution. And everybody has said that he's right and he's legally right to do it. And the Tories have tried desperately to sort of turn it into this sort of great big wedge and say that it's like, I mean, how do the Conservatives ever convince poor people that they really care about them more than the opposition? But anyway, that's what they've managed to sort of paint the picture of, like, ULEZ being the wedge that worked. And I think they know really that it wasn't that, because they technically had a whole bunch of other reasons why that worked. But
it was having people on the ground, organising, campaigning, doing leafleting. Yeah. They don't want it.
And now it's really, because people have got that in their minds, they've just watched that happen. And they think, well, actually air pollution and cars, the motoring lobby, you know, people who drive cars don't want these things, blah, blah, blah. Without any data to prove whether that ULEZ campaign is real or not, are the, you know, 200 people that show up sometimes rather than hundreds of thousands of people that campaign on climate. But, you know, it's on the front pages.
Yeah,
it's on the front pages of the newspapers. And that being able to be replicated on the entire green agenda on a national policy level. And I think that's what they're trying to do. It's a sort of a desperate attempt to create a political wedge in order to damage the opposition in any meaningful way that they possibly can, because they feel so likely to lose the next election. And I also know some people who are genuinely frightened that they might win the next election, because they're fighting at the moment in an extremely sort of like tactically smart and extremely aggressive way. And they've managed to turn the entire of our political discourse into a culture war with like almost no, there's not really anything that isn't. It's very difficult to fight that on whatever you think about Keir Starmer. It would be difficult for anyone to fight that on the grounds of like a true debate about real things, because the pitch is just, it doesn't work like that anymore. I think.
Well, that highlights the importance of people talking about these issues and seizing back the agenda, isn't it? Because this agenda is a manufactured one, as you say. It's, you know, it's been created as a wedge issue. But we know that most people, yeah, polling is always clear, most people want stronger climate action. Mm. So we're in this situation of it's like pluralistic ignorance, what we talked about before with the emperor's new clothes. Most people want climate action. And this, yeah, this alternative idea that we shouldn't be changing everything really, really urgently isn't actually popular. So one of the things, you know, the think tanks do through trying to, you know, set this media agenda and through all the work on social media and stuff is to try and give the impression that these things are more popular than they actually are, because then people are more likely to follow. I don't personally have any problem with traffic calming measures, but all these people online seem to be saying all the time that traffic calming measures are really, really bad. So maybe I'm wrong, maybe they are bad. But of course, this is, you know, it's not real grassroots opposition to these measures. It's manufactured with the aim of setting the agenda and creating this grassroots backlash against reaching net zero. And I think, yeah, so yeah, that's what the Conservatives seem to be hoping for, that they can, you know, help manufacture this grassroots backlash and then, you know, surf on the crest of a wave to electoral victory. It's a real worry, isn't it?
Yeah, and there were some things in his speech that were completely manufactured, like a tax on meat that no one's ever proposed and isn't supposed to happen, but now he's saved us from it. Stuff like that.
Thank you. Yeah, it's the worst kind of Trumpian politics, isn't it? I think, you know, just talking about stuff that doesn't even exist to manufacture outrage so we can all spend all our energies talking about and satirizing this stuff that doesn't exist instead of, you know, focusing on the really important task at hand,
on the things that do exist. So by contrast, I mean, we've got in America at the moment, there's maybe we talk about this another time, but there's been Climate Week in New York and a lot of people have been over there and I don't know. I need to look at it more to understand precisely what I think about it. But it feels like it's got an awfully liberal agenda that it's swimming in. However, in California, their governor, Gavin Newsom, has basically made these extraordinary moves. Maybe we can cut to the clip of this.
And I encourage anyone, in fact, I encourage everyone, including members of the board of directors of these companies, to read the complaint. Don't just have a paid spokesperson respond. Read the actual complaint, then respond. Or at least talk to your kids about why you're responding the way you're responding. You cannot read it without crawling out of your skin. The level of deceit, it's not even debatable now. We have the receipts, the evidence, it's overwhelming. And it's not contemporary. The deceit that's been around for 70 plus years that they have knowingly advanced in order to deny or delay progress and implementation to address this dis-ease with a planet now that's under duress, that they predicted would be under duress, and is now producing the results precisely as their own paid scientists had predicted. The fact that they're still at it, rolling back ambition in real time, Shell, BP, Chevron, rolling back ambition at the same time they continue to perpetuate this mythology And this rebranding campaign is shameful. And so we are stepping up our efforts in California, a state that long has prided itself on being on the cutting edge, on leading on the issues of low carbon, green growth. And perhaps there's never been anything more consequential than this lawsuit that we're putting forward. And it is my hope and expectation, as the Attorney General said, that we have more partners, that we get more jurisdictions, not just states, but nations around the world to do the same. And we've seen that in a number of other states. We're joining that fight, but at a scale and scope that the oil companies are familiar with, because California, as they know well, means business. We did it on cap and trade. Mary Nichols is here, the leaders, architects in that space. We've done it, low carbon fuel standards. We continue to lead the conversation, not just nationally, but globally. There's not a subnational jurisdiction anywhere on the globe that has more ambition. But now it's about the great implementation and application to address the impacts and the effects of this delay and these deceitful tactics. So with that sense of pride but responsibility, we assert ourselves forcefully into this space with the kind of, as I was saying a moment ago, moral authority that I think is required of this effort. We're not late to these conversations. Again, California's led these conversations. And it's not too late to address the impacts.
Just so uplifting to hear such proper political leadership, isn't it? And it's in such stark contrast to what's happening here in the UK, where, you know, the Conservative Party essentially seem to be the political arm of the fossil fuel industry. Here, the governor of California is, well, the state of California is taking five fossil fuel companies to court and accusing them of deception, essentially. The evidence is clear. Historians like Ben Franto and others in the US have compiled, Naomi Oreskes, have compiled all this evidence to show that the fossil fuel companies knew. They knew in the 50s and 60s. And since then, they have been trying to deceive us and trying to, you know, influence or to stop governments taking the action necessary. And it's just, of course, we've had lots of court cases all around the world. Lots of different people have been taking fossil fuel companies to court and taking governments to court for their inaction and everything. But what's so exciting about this for me is that it's a government that's taking fossil fuel companies to court, not a national government. It's the state of California. But this is proper political leadership, and it's exciting because it shows an alternative path, doesn't it? You don't have to go the way that the UK government is going and the US federal government and governments the other way are going. California, you know, is suffering because of the deception of these companies. People are losing their homes in California. The state is really, really vulnerable. And I don't know how closely linked that is. I don't know if it's all the fires they've had in California that has helped trigger this. But it is fantastic to see this leadership.
Well, yeah, and I mean, you know, putting it like that, it could be a question to ask, couldn't it? Because the people that I've heard about, like on a personal level, whose houses have burnt down in California, are phenomenally rich. Right, this is not like a place where the working poor are suffering.
Yeah.
This is a place where highly influential people with a lot of money and big fat houses are watching stuff go up in flames, and then they're going, shit.
Oh, now it's important.
Yeah, and it is. Well, but it's interesting, isn't it? Because I wonder how many people, you know, the sort of upper echelons of society in California are in contact with people who are traumatized because they watched their home burn down, people who are traumatized because they thought they were going to die because they thought they couldn't get out of a fire, you know. And I think you can't cast like a total judgment on that, but I do think it's that we have to ask ourselves at this critical time where things are unfolding, but there's still obviously so much room to do a lot of stuff, to prepare for what's happening and what's coming, and also to, you know, to launch hard into legal battles and mitigation efforts and, you know, all the rest of it. That it feels there could be a point where action becomes harder, I think, because people are so traumatized by what's taking place, you know, because society is so destabilized. People are spend all their time doing repairs. They can't do anything else because we're rebuilding everything. It's like, you know, at some point, presumably, an awful lot of effort just goes into trying to patch shit up and make
and
it.
Money.
Yeah. Yeah. So the other thing, I guess, about him, and we should come back to this another time, is that it reflects another case, which is, I think, going to be quite massive, which is this 32 countries are facing European court action from young people over their climate stance. So this is also, you know, it's another enormous story that we've got contact with people who are involved in it in XR. And, you know, when you look back at cases, like there was one that was involved, the people from our Internationalist Solidarity Network, the Stop the Mangamizi campaign, mm-hmm. some young people associated with that who were in court against the British state, claiming their right to family life, I think it was, and basically saying, you know, if you, as people with African family or South American family or people living in the Caribbean who are part of their family, they have a right to their family life under their sort of international human rights. And by taking climate policy that knowingly destroys those places or knowingly renders some of those places uninhabitable, you're damaging our personal human rights. So we should maybe look at that, because I seem to remember that the outcome was basically the higher courts in this country saying, well, yeah, that we don't think that's relevant. So this will be interesting, because I think as it steps up, there's like increasing more and more stuff to think about in terms of the legal strategy, because a lot of cases like this have already happened and don't always come to anything as monumental as we would like. So before we go, we need to celebrate Extinction Rebellion in the Netherlands.
Haven't they been amazing? It's been so uplifting to see. So, yeah, they've been blocking the A12, which is a massive road in Den Haag, The Hague in Holland. And they've been doing it in huge, huge numbers and for a long time. So they started, I think, on 9th September, and they had over 10,000 people out in the street, blocking the street and you know, vowing not to move. And they've been coming back day after day ever since. So there were over 3,000 arrests in the first day. The first 3 days. But we're now on to day 14 or 15, I think, and they're still there. I don't know if you saw that amazing video of the orchestra. Did you see that?
Yeah.
So the police, there'd been an orchestra, musicians from all sorts of different sort of orchestras around the country came together and they performed this piece. They were coming back to do it again, and the police said, no, you can't take your instruments. So they mimed it. They just sung the parts of their voices, mimed the violins, and it was just such a wonderful thing. So do check out this video if you can find it online. It really reminded me how much joy there is in our climate movement. The participants in that, when they got to the end, they were just so thrilled. They were just experiencing this real joy of having come together with other people and done something magnificent. And I think that's one of the most important things I've got in my life from since I've been part of XR, is this feeling of coming together with other great people and doing something magnificent. It's really brilliant.
And their whole thing is about ending fossil fuel subsidies, as I understand. That's the big demand of their campaign, which is very similar to what we've come out with as sort of an immediate demand in the UK, saying like we need to get off the fossil economy, or we need to end the fossil fuel era, we need to stop subsidising, stop new licensing. It's all the kind of same.
No brainer.
Very much the same, like very obvious first step that you'll sort of go, okay, can we just do this first? Even though they were being, you know, water cannoned at certain points, and you know, looked to me like in their vast numbers, they were able to, you know, stay there for a really long time. But then over 3,000 arrests in 3 days is an awful lot of people to get nicked. That means that the police are under this immense strain. And then tell us about this letter that came from the Dutch police got circulated.
Yeah, I think it's a really amazing illustration of one of the ways in which activism works. So the Dutch police union wrote to the Dutch government and they said, we're here to facilitate people's rights to protest, but you are placing these huge demands on us by making that illegal and by asking us to arrest these thousands of people. But you're not giving us extra resources to do it. And they basically asked the politicians to come out and speak to the protesters. They said, yeah, the protesters have a demand. They want to speak to the government. You're not coming out to speak to them. You're leaving the job to us. And that's fair enough to an extent because we are a branch of the government, but you're not making our job easy for us. Mm. You're not giving us the resources to do this. Will you please at least come out and speak to the protesters so we don't have to just arrest them? And it's fantastic to see this working because it's one of the sort of theoretical sort of theories of change behind XR's strategy since the beginning is that if so many people get arrested, it can sort of clog up the functioning of the state, make it harder to govern. Therefore, maybe the easiest thing is just to decarbonize instead. And here's the Dutch police sort of explicitly sort of vindicating that the way that approach might work. So personally, I think the most important aspect of mass protest isn't just that it puts direct pressure on the state, but that it sets an example to other people and shows other people that this is important. But all the same, it's really encouraging to hear from the horse's mouth, as it were, that protest is difficult to deal with. The police do not want it. The police would rather the government was taking action so we didn't have to protest.
Well, and it's critically how civil resistance is supposed to work. You go out, you're there again and again and again, you have enormous numbers, and eventually the forces that the state employ to suppress you say, we're not doing it anymore.
You can't do this anymore.
So I'm just noting this line at the end, deploying the police to oversee workload within an already overburdened force. Politics can prevent this by opening its doors, listening to concerned citizens and looking for a solution together. I mean
that's just common sense.
Why can't the
common
police
sense,
here write letters like that to the government?
But it is a fundamental point. This is a problem that is never going to go away until we sort it. And what governments are doing is nothing. It's just burying their heads, keeping their heads down, and not dealing with the problem. So the problem is just going to grow and grow and grow and going to be harder and harder and harder to deal with, including for the police, including for the government, including for the public, for everybody. So the police are just taking this very, very sensible position. Can we just start talking about it? Can we just start dealing with the problem, please?
Yeah. More power to the elbows of Extinction Rebellion Netherlands. And so we've got to close there, but before we go, it's just to say, please join Extinction Rebellion and other movements. Please donate to Extinction Rebellion and other movements. And Charlie, I think you need to invite people on something that you're doing quickly.
Yeah. If you can't join Extinction Rebellion or don't feel affiliated to any particular movement, there are, of course, lots and lots of different things we can do in our own lives to try and raise awareness of these issues. I happen to take part in civil disobedience myself. I believe very, very strongly in the power of civil disobedience. But I think there are other things we could do too that don't entail any risk of getting arrested. So what I'm doing, starting in a couple of days, is I'm going on a big walk to try and raise awareness. So where I live in Norfolk, the coasts are really threatened by sea level rise, and even really big inland areas are threatened by sea level rise. And I just find it incredible, the landscapes that we know and love, they're going to be transformed within decades. Tens of thousands of people live in homes that cannot be defended, and they're going to lose their homes. And yet no one's talking about it. Just no one is talking about this issue in the area. So I thought I'd walk through the whole region that's threatened and try and raise awareness. And unfortunately, we're in this crazy situation where tens of thousands of people having their homes threatened, not a news story. Mm. Some bloke walking past those homes in a mask and snorkel, suddenly, oh, wow, some bloke's walking in a mask and snorkel. And crazy, but that's how you get attention. So that's what I'm going to do. I'm going to walk 180 miles in a mask and snorkel through threatened places. It's called Walking in Water. Check out the website. And on that website, there's lots and lots of tips and resources for how to take action yourself. I'm not doing a sponsorship thing. I don't want your money. Giving 10 quid is really easy. I want you to take action and do things in yourself in your own life. So check out the website, check out social media, follow me on my walk. It should be fun.
That sounds brilliant. And make sure you send us some pictures. We'll talk about it.
I will do. I will do. And yeah, I look forward to chatting about it when we come back.
Cool.
Cheers.